Hello, big boys and girls, parents and grandparents, and everyone interested in AI and robotics. Here's Anastasia with AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie, a show for technology muggles, not wizards. Together with my guests, who are experts in AI and robotics, I translate AI and robotic technologies from difficult to easy to understand. And after having spent 30 years in technology and business executive roles in companies such as Munich Re, McKinsey, Deutsche Telekom, Qualcomm, and Dun & Bradstreet, I created AI Edutainment, a business which is focused on democratizing knowledge of AI with children and their clever parents. Today, I am joined in studio by Donaka Daly, a wonderful AI scientist and practitioner. Donaka is head of studies in AI and machine learning of the University of Applied Sciences in Lucerne, which is in central Switzerland. And besides, he is the founder and chairman of a fabulous AI B2B company called GOPF. Last but not least, and this is, by the way, the reason I called on Donaka to join me today. Donaka is co-founder and board member at Lucerne AI and Cognitive Sciences Hub. And after today's program, you will know what is the role of ecosystems and certain geographies in shaping the development of AI and robotics and their perception in the society. And so let's go. Donaka, welcome to my program. So grateful for your time. And before we are going into discussion about competitiveness of different ecosystems and what those ecosystems are, could you please talk a little bit about your own path, emphasizing 2 to 3 pivotal moments that led you to where you are today.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, Anastasia. I'd be very glad to tell you about my background before we get on to the interesting topics in AI. So I come from Dublin in Ireland, and I did my degree in electrical engineering, also my PhD in Dublin. And I guess one of the first pivotal moments was as part of that PhD program. I had the very fortunate luck to spend some time in Switzerland. I was did a stage at the EPFL in Lausanne, which is a very well-known university and also a world leader also in AI technologies. But this was quite some time ago. This was in 2001, so we're going back quite some time. And when I came here, I fell in love with Switzerland. That was in the French-speaking part. I now live in the German-speaking part. And I have to tell you that when you talk about pivotal moments, when I came from Ireland, that was, as I said, back 20 years ago. At the time, all of the research work that I did in the libraries, you had to photocopy all of your journal articles. When I came to Switzerland, and everything was, they had so much more money for infrastructure and for resources. The EPFL had the entire digital collection of engineering papers and research papers. I think I got more done in a few months in EPFL than I did in a few years back in Dublin, standing at the photocopier. So that for me was a great acceleration of the work that I did back then. I also was extremely lucky. I was working with one of the smartest people I ever met, Professor Vetterli, who at the time was leading the signal processing lab, but he's now the dean. He's the president of APFL. So working with such smart people with great resources really was my first kind of eye-opener. What is Switzerland? What's Switzerland all about? What a great country it is in terms of innovation. It still tops the Global Innovation Index every year, 13 years running. And it's a privilege to be here. And that's why I'm still here after a few decades in the country.
This is fantastic. And you've already mentioned working with smart people, that this is one of the key issues when we are discussing ecosystems. But before going into the location and the composition of this location and all the features connecting to this, could you give me your definition of AI? And you started decades ago, as I did. So I started in, 1989. I mean, long before we had GPUs and cloud and all those wonderful libraries. So what is your definition of AI?
I'm very happy to answer that. And it's one of the first things that we teach our students. So as you mentioned, I run a bachelor program in artificial intelligence. It's the first and largest such bachelor program in Switzerland. I think it's one of the first in Europe, because we haven't, we launched in 2020 and we didn't see any other programs like this. But the first thing on the first week, the first day of the first week, we tell our students, what is artificial intelligence? And it's a great question. We, despite the fact that we're a technical university, we don't use a technical definition. Yeah. We use a much more holistic definition, which is that it's a capability. So the definition we use is that artificial intelligence is the capability of machines and computers to do general cognitive tasks better, faster, and cheaper than humans. And when you talk to business people, when they hear the words better, faster, cheaper, it resonates much more than, for example, if you start to use a very deep technical definition. The other thing that's very important about that definition is that it's the word general. People say if you can do cognitive tasks, it's AI, but that's not sufficient. If you multiply two large numbers on a calculator, it's better, faster, and cheaper than a human, but that calculator can't learn to generalize how to do better computations, for example. So what I always say is it has to be able to generalize cognitive tasks of humans and to be able to do them better, faster, and cheaper than humans. And I think that's a pretty simple definition for everybody to understand.
This is absolutely so. And by the way, I really love it. I think it's really, it explains it in a language which is common to the humanity. And when we kind of, you know, review this and go into the history of AI, I mean, AI started in Europe. Probably it started in England with Alan Turing and his predecessors. And we were talking about the end of the 40s and the beginning of the 50s. And obviously Switzerland is one of the most powerful and important European countries, even if it's not a EU member. But when people think AI, they first think Silicon Valley and United States. They might think China and this competitive race, what I call the Cold War over the hot tech. So this competition in between of China and the United States. How come? So why did this gravity in AI research and development moved from Europe to the United States? What is your opinion?
So I think you can look at it in two sides to that question. One is more on the academic side, and the other is more on the commercial side. And they both have very similar answers. In both cases, the United States model is far more has far more appetite for taking risks on good people, on good and on good technologies, and on good business cases. So if you look at Silicon Valley, which is where Since the 80s, the 70s and the 80s, people have been willing to invest large amounts of capital into crazy new ideas and crazy new people with these new ideas. That's obviously a huge attraction for creative people, and you build up this ecosystem of talent. On the other hand, if you look at the universities, the American model for universities, particularly at the Ivy League end of things, was always ruthlessly elitist, which is not always true in Europe. We have some great universities, but this almost competitive nature of getting the best professors, the best students, and having a very, very high bar at the top universities for great talent has also meant that there's kind of pools of talent and pools of capital to make this happen. However, I will say it when we talk about artificial intelligence, it's not always just Silicon Valley, and it's not always just America. If you look at the winners of the Turing Award, so Joshua Benigo and Jeffrey Hinton, who now won the Nobel Prize, and Yann LeCun, who's the head of AI at Meta, they did all their work in Canada. And I actually see Toronto and Montreal as almost as important, or if not as important as Silicon Valley, when it comes to being at the home of artificial intelligence. I've been saying this for quite some years, and then suddenly we see Jeffrey Hinton wins the Nobel Prize, and now it's suddenly become a reality that Toronto is now recognized as a gravitational hotspot for for AI talent and research.
It's absolutely. And I think Hinton, if I'm not mistaken, but he's from Scotland. So he moved to the United States at some point in his career. I'm not sure about Jan. So obviously he's French speaking, but I think he's really from France, from continental Europe, and not from the French speaking Canada.
That's right. He went to Bell Labs originally. And then he was actually a postdoc under Hinton, and he did a lot of work on convolutional neural networks and the MNIST data set and number recognition back in the day. And Yoshio also, I think, is Italian speaking, originally European. So you see these great European talents, and they move to the US, pools of talent, pools of capital, and an appetite for some risk that perhaps we could do more of here in Europe.
No, absolutely. There are some lessons learned, but could you maybe define the ecosystem for me? So obviously, university is one aspect, and it's tremendously important. When I was looking into $1 trillion companies, all of those are actually data-centric and AI-centric, and they all, so those are those traditional suspects, right? So Amazon, Apple, Meta, just please help me with that. So Amazon, Meta, Apple,
fine companies.
Yes. So the big tech. Yes. So they all have on the top of their data science teams fantastic professors. Right. And those professors, they still are active in their universities. And they, of course, pull this university talent to the pipeline of talent acquisitions of those very large and very important companies. So Alphabet, obviously, is the fourth, right? So, and this is very important to build the link between academia and application and applied research if you want to win in the game of innovation. But what else? What do you think? So what else contributes to the ecosystem?
Absolutely. So I think if you look at Silicon Valley, it's always what I said already. It's pools of talent, pools of capital, and a willingness to take a risk. Let's move across the Atlantic and start to look at Europe and see where is that happening, where does it succeed, and maybe what are we doing wrong, maybe where we could learn. So there are places in Europe like London, like Paris, pockets of places like Estonia, Helsinki, and certainly in Zurich, where there is a critical mass of talent, especially artificial intelligence talent. We've got quite a few startups. You also have very close links to universities, as you described, so you would have the professors connected somehow to these startup companies. But what we miss here is, you talk about success factors, we don't see a lot of unicorns being born out of these startup ecosystems or these pools of talent. What you often see is perhaps early stage startups do very well. And then there's later stage startups where you get to talk about private equity and larger scale investments, where there is also deep pools of capital and a willingness to invest in Europe. But that mid-market sector, the kind of 5 million to 50 million or maybe 2 million to 20 million post-seed stage, not quite Series A stage, where you have to take a big risk on a small team in an early market, that's really missing that I've seen in Europe as compared to the United States. And I think that's no secret. I think everyone you talk to in these markets would acknowledge that and would recognize that. I think there's actually a gap in the market. I think if any kind of investors could come here and take advantage, arbitrage that opportunity, I think there's really lots of great young European tech teams spinning out of universities, getting very, very low valuations compared to equivalent teams in North America. But what are the other success factors, even better than investor money? What's the best thing a startup can get? It's customer money. They need companies who are willing to buy their products and take a bet on a small company that's maybe got a cool new technology. And in North America, that's where, and particularly in Anglo-Saxon countries like UK as well, where companies, they don't look at your pedigree or your track record. They look at the technology. Is this a cool product? Does it solve my problem? Is it cost effective? You're not seeing those conversations. They're like, well, who are these young guys? Do I know their family? You know, that kind of European mentality to decision making. Let's have lunch 5 or 6 times before we make a decision, which is very inefficient and draining. Well, you know, there's a colleague of mine, a business partner of mine. He came up with a phrase called venture customer, which I really like. As opposed to venture capital, right? Venture capital is great if you're a young company and you're trying to get started, because then you've got investment. You can build a team and build a product. But what companies want is, or what startups want is, they want venture customers. I'm going to take a bet on your product, 20,000 Swiss francs, 50,000 Swiss francs. If I'm a big multinational with $1 billion of quarterly revenue, you should be doing that. You should be helping young companies, taking a bet on the product, because from a venturing perspective, you're going to find some diamond in all the coal that actually transforms your business and is useful to you. And especially now when these small companies can do so much more with so little capital, because AI enables that, right? Sam yeah. Altman talked about the one-person billion-dollar company, which I think is possibly an exaggeration, who knows? But certainly small teams of 4, 5, 10, 15 people can deliver what it used to take 50, 60 people to deliver. So if you're a company person, you're in a big corporate and you're thinking, how do I get my company to be innovative? Become a venture customer.
Yeah. And actually for companies, so being someone who had T-Ventures under my area of responsibility, I remember those discussions with legal teams, you know, so those things don't apply. And what if this company is out of business in 3 years from now and 4 years from now? And who is their compliance head? Well, I mean, startups don't have a compliance heads most of the time. Where did they prove this themselves? Maybe they are very new, the new kid around the block. And then there's another issue. So all those liability clauses with large companies. So what if introduction of this new product and service damages my whatsoever and exercises, let's say, take over control in a large chunk of my business? What does it mean for me? So those are very difficult discussions. I have an impression that companies don't have, I would say, an infrastructure to test fast and then move on or remove. So what is your impression here? And you are a founder yourself, so it's not only the professor speaking here, but a founder.
So you're exactly right. And that's why I say it's so important, because it doesn't exist. There's the idea of companies who have a ring-fenced innovation process which allows them to buy from startups as opposed to invest in startups is quite limited. There was a big trend. It's kind of disappeared a little bit, but there was a big trend for, let's say, the last decade of corporate venture capital. And big companies like ABB and Siemens and so on, they would ring-fence almost a separate unit to do venture capital,
yeah.
Strategic venture capital on behalf of their organization. And it's gone out of fashion a little bit, maybe because startups don't like it, I'm not sure. But one of the things I would say is take that model, because the capital is there, right? Take that model and work out how to ring fence that from a customer, like working with them as a partner rather than as an investor, buying their products and services as a customer. I haven't really seen that. So at the moment, it's still traditional graft. So to get your B2B sales contract, you still have to go have the 5 or 10 meetings for a $20,000 contract, right? Which almost doesn't make it worthwhile. But if you're a big company and you give that first contract a little bit easier, and you give them, let them put their logo on your website, that $50,000 contract as a customer contract is much more valuable than as an angel investment.
Yeah. And it's so interesting what you are saying, because once again, I'm remembering my own day at the Deutsche Telekom, so with these T-Ventures, and I'm talking 2008, 2009, 2010. We followed investments of Kosla and Sequoias, and you name them. But what was very interesting, once we provided capital to kind of, you know, complement the investment round, it was not a guarantee for those companies to flourish within the Deutsche Telekom ecosystem. ecosystem of businesses. So it was another hurdle to say, okay, so now we are investing and we might benefit financially because, you know, at some point in time, those businesses might exit and we make money. But it's like, let's use what is out there and simplify how we plug in what is out there in terms of third-party innovation into the Deutsche Telekom pipeline. That was quite difficult. And sometimes difficulties were around how many people have a say and how many boxes must be checked. And it's okay if you are a supplier as large as Siemens, but for a little company of 20 people, that might be an unprecedented hurdle. So are you experiencing the same with what is going on today in Switzerland?
Yeah, Switzerland is a little bit different than maybe a larger country like Germany, France, or Italy, where there definitely is a lot more of those hurdles. Where Switzerland is a little bit unique is that, and you certainly wouldn't be able to experience this in Germany or France, a small company with like a 5-person company is probably 2 phone calls away from the CEO or C-level executive in any Swiss-based company. There's only 8 million people in Switzerland. Or what is it? 9 million people in Switzerland now. It's a very, and if you look, they kind of stay in the French part or stay in the German speaking part. And if you just look at that sub community, to get access to big successful logos that are here in Switzerland, like ABB, like UBS, like Migros Bank, or like all of these kind of big names that are known in the country. It's small enough that with one or two LinkedIn requests or one or two phone calls, you can pretty much guarantee you're going to meet someone important enough to buy your product or have a worthwhile discussion. That is also an advantage. When you ask why is Switzerland such an innovative country and a good location to do business, it's because some of those process hurdles that you mentioned, while they still exist when you get to the procurement teams, you don't necessarily have to start with procurement, right? You can start with the business people who are maybe going to benefit from the value. And then that makes things a little bit easier. So I do think to Germany, compared to France, we have an advantage here.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, and, you know, before we go into this Lucerne AI and Cognitive Sciences Hub, let me ask you one thing. So if you are a company in China or in the United States, you might immediately get scale because, you know, of the use of language, etc. So Switzerland already, I mean, we have 4 national languages here. So it's German, it's French, it's Italian, and Romanian. So this is already like a mini European Union in itself with even more languages. And I remember when I was heading Qualcomm Europe, we were talking about 900 million customers, potential customers, but how to scale in an environment which is so diverse culturally, linguistically, in terms of how to structure the micro segments and macro segments of the markets. So what is your answer to that? Because this might be one of the issues why big venture capitalists are not coming. They are afraid how to scale.
And their fear is correct. Scaling in Europe is tricky. It's really tricky. We don't do ourselves any favors by having, you know, different regulations for even things like plug sockets or energy market regulations and so on in different countries. I'm Irish. I'm a huge believer in the European Union project. Switzerland is not a member of the European Union. The United Kingdom is not a member. Norway is not a member of the European Union. But as an Irish person, who we're a small open economy, we don't have any natural resources. When I saw, for example, what happened in the Brexit negotiations with the United Kingdom, how all of Europe behind us was able to take our position as a European member of the European Union, Ireland was able to negotiate a very strong position in the Brexit negotiations. Things like the not to have a hard border on our Ireland, the customs. Questions, a line down the Irish Sea, all of these questions, which were very tricky political questions. The fact that we had the European Union behind us, Germany, France, Spain, Italy, made us very powerful. And I think even though I'm Swiss, I have a Swiss passport now and I've been here a long time, I'm still a big believer in the European Union project in terms of, if you want to be able to scale, you need a single market that you can sell into with very low friction, no customs, low borders, standardizations, and so on. And so I think that's something that is an advantage of the European Union, but the project is not finished. Project is kind of has kind of stopped. On the other hand, parts of that project have been a disaster, right? The things like the European AI Act, right, which has put us a decade behind the China and the United States of America, but by saying, look, we're going to stop growth, we're going to put hurdles for small companies, you can't take risks, and so on. I'm a very big believer in the motivations behind it. I totally believe in. We need to protect the consumer. We need to protect our privacy. Yeah. We need to ensure that children are not harmed. All of these things are super important. But they've thrown out the baby with the bathwater.
Yes.
They've used the sledgehammer to crack the nut. We're left in a position of huge disadvantage with this. Now, Switzerland and the United Kingdom, the two countries I mentioned earlier, who are outside of the European Union, do have a strategic advantage. And you can already see that. The latest words coming out of the United Kingdom, I think you were there last week, right, is that they're going to build data centers. They're going to allow large language models to be trained in a much more flexible way.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be a huge strategic advantage if they get that right. I think Switzerland has a huge role to play here from a regulatory sandbox perspective to allow companies to innovate flexibly, especially at the startup level. To come to the next level. I mean, at the end of the day, the European Union is the largest export market for Switzerland. So in some shape or form, we will adopt a lot of the regulations eventually that are in there, but we do it a little bit more slowly and a little bit more cautiously. And it does give us a window of opportunity to strategically jump ahead, especially in artificial intelligence and data technologies.
No, you are so right. And by the way, this is why I moved to Switzerland. I just think it's not just that the capital is here and there's more openness to explore. And Swiss are very innovative in their approaches how to improve companies. But this is the absence of the European AI Act openness to try and to learn. And I don't think that by forbidding things we necessarily reduce risks. I think we need to learn, and we absolutely must watch those areas to watch, such as how do we use data, how do we approach copyrights, etc., etc. But it doesn't mean we can't execute on beneficial AIs and beneficial robotic applications for all of us. But let me come now to Lucerne. And so my audience will be just very curious, how did it all start? And, you know, maybe please describe the history. Please describe the actors. What did the city of Lucerne or Swiss governance or whoever did? And what is happening now? And what do we need to learn from places like Shenzhen and Silicon Valley and Boston and I don't know what?
Yes, the reason I'm smiling, I'm very happy to tell this story because I'm very proud of it. It's a great success story. And for your listeners who don't know, we have something called the Lucerne AI and Cognitive Community. It's called LAC Squared. And it's an initiative which started around 2020, so before ChatGPT and all the big wave of hype that came along. And it came from several different players with several different motivations. I was one of the founders, and the motivation that I had was very, very straightforward. I run a bachelor program with almost 200 students. And what I love about the Swiss education system is the type of bachelor that we have in the applied sciences universities. You must do it with a local company or with a company on a real data set. So how do I get 200 bachelor projects? Do I spend the whole day just phoning companies and doing cold calls? Clearly, that's very inefficient, and there has to be a better way. And the idea that I had, or that we had with the team, was let's build a not-for-profit community where all of the AI activities that are going on in central Switzerland are visible. We bring the students together, we bring the companies together, we bring the public sector together, and at least we lift the lid and we see what's going on in the region. And you may say, well, why was that even needed? I mean, everybody knows, like, a place like Zurich, there's so much going on, right? And Zurich is only 45 minutes away, which I know this sounds ridiculous to people who are in big cities like London or Paris or wherever, but it's actually a world away. Lucerne is a tourism city. There's a lot of agriculture. There's a lot of 100-year-old companies doing manufacturing, like top of their game, world leaders in what they do, but in kind of small to medium enterprises, family businesses that are extremely well run, as opposed to, let's say, a tech hub like Zurich, connected to one of the top 10 universities in the world at ETH Zurich. And so I wouldn't call it a rural, but a regional area, which is maybe not necessarily a big tech history in terms of ICT technologies, how's it going to not get left behind? You know, if a Google is paying a $200,000 salary to a young engineer, why would they work for an agricultural machinery company in Lucerne as a data scientist when you can get, you know, a huge salary just an hour up the road? And so what we really wanted to do with the other players in there, we had the Foreign Direct Investment Association for Lucerne, that's the Lucerne business. We had some local startups. We had some big companies. We've got Cisco as one of the leaders of Cisco on our board. What we wanted to do for the region, we say, how do we help a region like this, which is not necessarily a London or a Paris or a Zurich, right, mm-hmm. but a local region, how do you ride the AI wave and not get left behind and even stay ahead and succeed? And so we started that journey about 4 years ago. And I'm incredibly proud of what we've done. What we've done is we've awoken and, in fact, uncovered. There was a lot of activity, right? There's a lot of companies. These are smart companies. They're doing good work. But they might have one data scientist or two data scientists. They don't have an army of data scientists like some big company up in Zurich. And they don't necessarily have a forum for dialogue. They don't have a place where they can interact and share their experiences. But now they do. And so what we do is we run a lot of events. Every month we have an AI breakfast. The room is full at 7 o'clock in the morning. If it's raining outside and it's dark and it's the middle of winter, they're still there, because there's a huge appetite for people to exchange on these topics. And they come together, and every time I see, like, I go to these breakfasts or these, we have executive roundtables. Almost every single one of these events that we've had, I've seen a project come out of it. Either a student is doing a project with a company, or two companies end up signing a contract because one has an AI technology that is actually a good match to the problem that this company has. Or maybe it's not technology, it's a regulatory question. Hey, I don't know how to solve this from a regulatory perspective. Hey, we're a local law firm, we specialize in this. Hey, let's meet and do something together. So that's the first stage of the journey, is we've brought everybody out of the woodwork. There's a vibrant community, and we've got great political support from both the federal government and the canton of Lucerne. We aim to serve central Switzerland, so we talk to Zug, Nidwalden, and Uri, all the cantons that are around. And our core strategic priority over the next couple of years is really to make central Switzerland on the map in terms of what we're doing in AI, machine learning, data science, robotics, those technologies. And I have to say, even if I say it myself, I think we've done a really good job, and that's not self-praise. It's really the team, the local community, the government, everybody's has realized that this is very strategic for the region, and they want us to succeed in this.
You know why I love this story? So we can spend hours talking about algorithms and models and one this LLM and not that LLM. But ultimately, it's all about people. It's about the human factor. And it's about leadership. Because there were a couple of people who said, okay, so we stick our heads together and we do something. And they started doing something, right? There is no borderline saying you can't excel in working with AI. You can always invite one expert or another, and you will find local little plans, which might be those little AI companies requiring attention and funding and first customers. And this is why I love this story so much. I think it could be a template for countless European locations. because we are here to stay with AI and to develop our economies with help of AI and robotics.
I totally agree. And I think when you say a template, I think there's a lot of places who wouldn't need our model. But I think that, you know, the vast majority of cities are not 8 million people cities. They're 800,000 people cities,
yeah.
80,000 people cities. And they like, how can we be successful? So this kind of regional, let's call it the SMEs of the city world, right? The small to medium sized cities, SMCs. These smaller regional hubs can also succeed using this template. And I think it's very, very successful. And I'm really proud of the fact that there is now a huge and active, vibrant AI community in central Switzerland.
This is fantastic. So congratulations on all the success. I'm wrapping up. That was an AI snack with Romy, Robbie, and Donaka. And we were discussing local ecosystems which are shaping the world of AI and robotics today. And I will see you next week. Goodbye. And please order Romy, Robbie, and The Secrets of Sleep, my very first AI book for the whole family on Amazon. Goodbye.
Goodbye.